In this presentation from the O'Reilly Media 2007 Emerging Technology Conference, Rafe Koster discusses the theory of fun from IT Conversations. Hi, this is Phil Wendley, the executive producer of IT Conversations. Today, I'm happy to bring you another presentation from O'Reilly Media's Emerging Technology Conference.
This program is underwritten by the Kinetics Developers Conference, 2 days of learning cutting-edge tools for building client-side web applications and cross-platform browser extensions in Provo, Utah, on November 18th and 19th. The Kinetics banner is on the IT Conversations homepage. Our audio files are delivered by Limelight Networks, the high-performance content delivery network for digital media. The Conversations Network is a 501c3 nonprofit, and we need your help. For a tax-deductible donation of as little as $5 per month, you can support this channel and the rest of the Conversations Network. So please visit conversationsnetwork.org to become a member and help us continue to bring our programs to the world for free.
And now, here's our presentation from eTech.
Up next is Rafe Koster. Now, Rafe, I actually have been trying to get to come and speak at eTech for the last couple of years, and he couldn't make it the last couple for various reasons. But he has this great book, if you've not already read it. It's this wonderful book called The Theory of Fun. And one of my favorite cartoons is sort of this character going through and thinking about the game all the time, always thinking about the game. And I think everyone here can identify with that. Think about the game while driving, think about the game while on the beach, and so forth. Think about the game over dinner, and then his significant other sort of pointing at the thought bubbles saying, stop thinking about the damn game. And I've always enjoyed that, because I know it's, you know, as a programmer, it just keeps, that's sort of how it feels to be inventing things. So it's just always really driving me. Anyway, Rafe Koster.
Yo! I'm a visitor from an alien world, because I'm not really one of you web people. I'm a game guy. That's the world I come from. I've been doing those whole virtual world, massively multiplayer things for quite a long time. And look at that. This is on the wrong slide still. Haha. So Rail wanted me to talk a bit about game design stuff, actually. So I'm going to do that. So if you've been looking for wonderful statistics and great detail about how social media and stuff are working and all those cool things, I'm afraid you're going to be disappointed. Instead, I'm going to talk really fast about some really cool stuff that's been going on over in the game world that I think you guys can probably use for what you guys are doing in terms of social media, Web 2.0, and all that other cool stuff. Theme of the conference is magic. So I wonder if all the guys in the room could please start on this beat going doom, 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 doom. Use your voices, your bass drums. Could the ladies please start providing? All right. Interaction designed in action. I don't know how many of you do music. If you recognize this thing on the board here, the blues progression. That's how magic works. Structure. Here's how it doesn't. Everybody, please make whatever sound you want. Yeah. Things that work have underlying structures to them. This is replicated throughout nature. It's replicated in physics. It's replicated in great art. It's replicated in good social media. And sometimes these structures get crazy elaborate. Well, I just gave you, I have no idea what key I was fake kazoo trumpeting in, but here's a complicated bit. Lots of complicated jazz chords. I'm not going to try doing that one. And yet, it still follows the same underlying structure. Solar by Miles Davis is still a blues. We can identify it with the ear, even though actually the best computer programs doing harmonic analysis have real trouble telling that this tune is a blues. In pretty much all disciplines, we call this a grammar, right? Grammar just means how bits fit together. And I know it conjures up all of these horrible, horrible memories of grade school and having to parse sentences and stuff like that. Really honest, it's not that bad, right? Grammars are underlying all the ways in which we communicate. They structure information. The interesting thing about grammars is that their logic is fractal, okay? You can look at something at a really high level and see a structure to it. And then you take one piece of it and you break it down and you see more structure to it. So, you know, sorry to echo grade school again, or grammar school, but you take a sentence, you break it into subject and object, and then you take those and you break them down further and you start looking at specific words. You break the words down, they break down into syllables. You take the syllables down, you start messing with phonemes, and it just keeps going down and down and down. And in fact, when you look at even blues, you'll find that the structure cuts has this kind of recursive quality to it. So in the blues I did, there was doo-da-da-da-down, right? And there you go, that's the one. Doo-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. You go start moving up, and then eventually you get the da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. You come back down to the one. And there's this rising thing, we call it the 1-4-5. In fact, we were just listening to U2, Three Chords and the Truth. Every goddamn U2 song is 1-4-5. You can play them all actually with D, G, and A. So it turns out, though, that the only thing that really matters, the 4, is just a passing chord. You just go move on through it, because all it does is take you to the 5. Da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da. That's all you really need. And it turns out, if you break that down even further, the only thing that matters in the 5 is one note, what we call a leading tone. You start at la, and then you go la, la. That's all of music. Is about that one note moving to the other next note, and back again. This is deep structure. And the interesting thing is, what it means is that songs, honest, I'll get off the music in a minute, trust me. Songs are actually made up of smaller songs, simpler songs. And in fact, even complicated stuff, like say, a fugue by Bach, okay, is not only made up of lots of smaller songs, but it's made up of overlapping songs, where you can take each voice and listen to it as a song. And anybody here who's ever heard sung harmony knows how this works, where each person is singing their own tune. This kind of grammar carries through to absolutely everything. So here is this famous painting by Van Gogh, which I suggest to you is actually made up of a lot of smaller paintings glued together on the edges. This is a classic piece of structure called the golden section. Right? It's those of you into fractal math probably know this already. Really, really neat. You can chop this up, and each of these squares is a good painting on its own. Right? That's a deep structure. In the same way, what I do, game making, games are made out of games. Right? So when you look at the latest big, cool game that you guys are playing, maybe it's World of Warcraft, I don't know what it might be, you have the giant game, and then you have lots of small games that you play within it. And really, in terms of what you guys do, in terms of designing Web 2.0 technologies and so on, the same kind of principle applies. You design a site, but you design a page, but you design an individual combo box, and you design an individual button, and so on down the line. So think about Frogger, for example. You guys all played Frogger? Ribbit? Yeah? Good. So, you look at Frogger here, you have the game of getting a high score. In order to beat that game, you have to the game of getting your frog and filling all 5 of the spots on the other end. And to win that game, you have the game of getting one frog to fill one spot on the other end. In order to beat that game, you have the game of crossing the road and the game of crossing the logs. In order to beat that game, you have the game of trying to master hopping and timing and so on. And it's, you know, turtles all the way down. Until you reach the interface button, which is the game that hopefully you can't lose at. Right? That's the act of going click is something we take for granted. You're not going to screw that up. That's the point at which the atomic grammar, you know, it reaches its bottom level. So the interesting thing about this is that games, at each of those individual games, has to be fun. And we as game designers spend a hell of a lot of time obsessing about making even each of those individual little micro games entertaining. Which, you know, clearly, you know, the designers of typical application productivity software don't. So it seemed to me that maybe it would be interesting for you guys to learn about how we do that and how you could apply this kind of deep structure. So the first thing to realize is that fun is something moderately well understood at this point. We actually know where it comes from. It comes from the same place as chocolate and orgasms, which is to say a drip of endogenous morphines down your brainstem. Okay? So we are, in some sense, drug pushers. That is what we're trying to do. But fun also arises because of certain characteristics. You're meeting a challenge, understanding the pattern that is presented, learning how it works through a process of experimentation, poking at something, seeing what response you get, mastering the way the model works. And if you want, you could almost think of it as like one of those Calder mobiles that you can poke at and it spins in particular ways and then it settles back into position. That's how games work. And then at the end, when you master it, when you figure out how it works, that moment, I made it all the way to the end, woohoo, frog is safe, then you get your little drip of drugs. So there's actually interesting empirical research on exactly what the kinds of fun are, because they do arise in different circumstances. This particular diagram is taken from the work of a woman named Nicole Lazzaro, who works at XEO Design, XEO Design, for anybody who's on their laptop as we speak, because I'm boring. Four broad kinds. Hard fun, where you're meeting these tough challenges and have to figure out and master a problem. This is kind of the tough stuff, right? This is what we think of games as being. Easy fun, which you, in the book, I refer to it as moments of aesthetic delight. These are the moments when you come to something and you go, oh, that's really pretty, or that's really relaxing, that's really enjoyable in that sense. Visceral fun, this is the moment on the roller coaster where your stomach falls out through your feet and you go, damn, that was fun. And then finally, social fun. Because games are social media, games are just about always played in the company of other people. And one of the most fun parts of a game is a lengthy German verb that we now use all the time, Schadenfreude, which is to say gloating is one of the most fun parts of games. Games honestly mostly focus on hard fun because that's kind of the core of them, is presenting tough problems and making you solve them. And you can have really hard fun games that are lacking in the other bits. So for example, playing a game of Go against a computer, not particularly visceral, not particularly social, you know, not particularly pretty either, right? So it doesn't have that aesthetic stuff. But it can be incredibly fun and compelling. So, finally, to the meat of the talk. Am I on track? Not too bad. So, there's a grammar, it turns out, to how these things work. It turns out that you can decompose a move in Go into a couple of characteristics, and using the grammar, make the interaction more or less fun. And there's actually been a fair amount of study on this, and that's actually what I want to walk you through. Because, of course, we're talking about users interacting with a system and getting a feedback response. We're talking about interaction design when we talk about game design. In fact, one of my favorite descriptions of interactivity actually comes from a game designer named Chris Crawford, who described interactivity as a cyclic process where two actors listen, think, and speak. So how do you apply this to technology? Let's hit Amazon real quick. Front page of Amazon, very much like coming to a game when you first start, with a whole bunch of nested objectives and parallel objectives. If you presented this as a design document, I would fire you, right? In terms of interaction design, I'm not picking on Amazon. I use it every goddamn day, and I just got my latest associate's check, actually. But thinking of it in these terms, in terms of the moment-to-moment fun, this is a really large and daunting list, right, of a lot of things that you need to work through. It's like having an endless chain of logs and turtles, and not much feedback, honestly, for each step, right? You don't get good feedback in Amazon for comparing the search results. In a game, we would try to find some way to do that. All of these challenges, you're trying to buy a particular book or something, right? You're trying to look up the right O'Reilly book for whatever you're doing. That's your ultimate goal, but you have all of these challenges that you have to pursue in parallel. You know, and you might find that you end up buying multiple books, so you're meeting the same challenge multiple times, right? And each time, the question is it as fun to buy your fifth book as it is to buy your first book? And in a game, it has to be. Fifth orc versus first orc. So here's those magic ingredients, and here's where you want to start scribbling down if you're going to take notes on how to apply this stuff. The magic ingredients are these, but you know, this has all kinds of technical terminology in it, so I'm going to boil it down into clearer words. The first thing is, where you meet the challenge matters. The process of buying a book on that product page versus buying it from search results and so on should matter to how you experience the event. When you buy it should matter. It should matter what pages you came from previously, what your past interactions are with the service. It should matter how you buy it. And most importantly, the way in which you buy it has to involve skill on your part, which is why shopping on eBay is more fun than shopping on Amazon. There has to be a range of challenges. In other words, what are you buying should make a difference. It should feel different to buy a book versus buying electronics on a site like this, because slaying an orc should feel different from slaying a dragon. What you do it with should matter, and I'm not talking Amex versus Visa, but what tools that you bring to the problem should matter. You know, in a game, it matters whether you're coming to this with a sword or if you're coming to it with a bow and arrow. It should feel different. Users should have tools as they come to their medium. What you're buying it for should matter. At the end of it, you shouldn't just get a book. There needs to be variable feedback. You need to be told you did that really well or you did that poorly. In games, it really matters that sometimes you don't get what you want, that you meet a challenge and you don't get everything. And that's because that's what drives people to keep coming back. And finally, when you fail to get something, the game needs to smack you on the head and go, "You idiot." It's really important for games to tell you that you failed at something. And the reason that matters is because fun fundamentally comes from learning. And, you know, failure is very important. So as I walk through these, I want you guys to start thinking, I may use game examples, but think here in terms of social media and the kinds of things that, how you could apply these to various other kinds of technology. A verb is an objective, okay? It is the goal that you are trying to learn, okay, so to speak. So for example, in a game, it might be destroy or capture. On a commerce site, it might be buy. In a social site, it might be connect, okay? It doesn't really matter what the verb is, because there are games that are about buying and connecting, too. The first thing is, this has to be a repeatable activity. If it isn't something people care to come to do over and over and over and over again, whatever your project is will not be fun and it will fail. Think, for example, social networking sites, where adding another link kind of pales after a while. It has to involve skill. You have to be able to do it better or worse. This is why eBay is a huge reason why purchasing on eBay is compelling. After you do it for a while, you start figuring out tricks, right? A lot of people play the game of sniping purchases at the last minute. They have their tips and tricks. They know how to evaluate particular buyers and sellers, all that kind of thing. The reason for this is because in order to learn, you have to feel like you're growing more competent. And this is where enjoyability comes from. Fun comes from a growth in competence. It has to be something that as you come to accomplish it, there can be lots of possible variant challenges to it, okay? So connecting to a CEO on LinkedIn versus connecting to the PR dude, different, okay? They might present different challenges, and you want to bring your different skills to bear on these different in these different situations. And what you want is for the game to acknowledge the fact that it's way, way tougher to get on, you know, Reid Hoffman's LinkedIn list than it is to get on, you know, random person who's desperate for some ads on MySpace. Lastly, this may seem weird. We talk about social media and how it's all about cooperation. The core of games is competitive. You're competing against a challenge, you're competing against yourself, and you're competing against everybody else. If soon as you give people a ladder to climb, they're going to climb it. And if you want compelling content and technology, you have to give them ladders to climb and things to see. And the commonest ways of doing this are, of course, ratings and other metrics of contribution and so on. Incredibly important. And other people need to be able to see it so they can measure against it. Everything that you have done must matter. In Frogger, right, there goes the log, and I hop on this log instead of that log. That needs to matter, that I chose this route versus that route. And the system you're interacting with needs to remember that. Amazon should know that you came to this via the search page versus you came to it via direct link. Amazon does actually know, but the question is whether they're telling you and how much it matters to you, right? Users find that very compelling, that the system is allowing them to make cumulative choices and follow a decision path and respond to the fact that they did things in different ways. The last interaction you had should matter. The fact that your opponent in chess moved a particular piece in a particular way changes everything. And when interacting with technology, it should be the same way. Whatever the response was, whatever the feedback was that you last got from a device, should change the situation. When it doesn't, we call it bad UI, because there was no feedback, you can't tell whether what you did anything. The core element of games here. I guess the way I'd translate is this. In terms of interaction design, you should never, ever, ever start a given encounter with really anything without there being an awareness of the previous context of the interaction. What else has the user already done? The user should be able to prepare for the encounter. They should be able to consciously say, I'm going to go into eBay this time having established a reputation already, or not. Having registered or not. They need to be able to come to the situation and prepare in different ways for taking on the challenge. In an RPG, this might be, you know, choosing what equipment to wear to the given battle, right? And it's important. You'll be able to do it in different ways. And this means that when you come, for example, to a social media site, it should matter what kinds of things you are bringing to the table in advance. Because different users, particularly as they explore different profiles, are going to want to come to it again and again, preparing in different ways, presenting different personas, presenting different profile information, and seeing what responses the system gives them for this different context. Doing the same thing in different places should make a difference. And this is because users are seeking novelty and they're seeking new scenarios and situations. So, for example, in a fighting game, you know, there you go to do your flying kick. It matters whether you're doing it this end of the screen where you can fly all the way across, or at this end of the screen where you're going to slam into a wall when you do the kick, right? Similar situations should arise in any kind of interaction design. If you are buying a book off the search page versus buying a book off the results page for that individual page, that should matter. If you're buying it off the author's page, it should matter. It should be a fresh scenario. In games, we refer to this as the topology of the environment. So if you go back to chess again, for example, different pieces have very different ways of interacting with the environment. If you are here and you're a knight and you want to get over there, right, the topology is very different depending on what the other pieces are, right? That spot might actually be a death trap. So very similar thing arises in all forms of interaction design, where the things that surround the task that you want to accomplish should affect how you can do the task. You should be able to do this task on many, many different challenges, okay? What it is that you're trying to accomplish. Is it buying a book? Is it buying electronics? Is it whatever it is, right? Is it making a friend, or is it, as Dana says, really just in order to hook up and have sex? The same verb, which is connect, is what's in place there. But the reason to do it is very different. And the target that you're doing it on is very different. The way to think of this is that a given verb that you supply in your interaction design, right, like buy, is a hammer. And what you want to do is give users lots of kinds of nails. Because if you give them something they enjoy doing, like buying, then they will try applying it, once they've mastered that tool, they'll try applying it to all kinds of different things. All of a sudden, buying isn't just buying objects. It could be buying membership in something. It could be buying a one-day experience, buying an event, buying a friend, who knows. Shouldn't forget there's lots of kinds of hammers, too, not just lots of kinds of nails. Users should come to any form of interaction design and be able to choose from any of an array of tools with which to solve the problem. In e-commerce, this is kind of boring because it's Amex versus Visa, right? But for example, connecting to somebody on a social networking site, there should be lots of ways to approach that problem. Introduction emails, referrals, forums for common interests, right? If what you really, really want to do is meet that cute potential significant other, right, you want to have a multiplicity of ways of reaching that goal. Critically, the system should be giving you different feedback based on how you did it, right? All too often in what we do, we just tell you, you have accomplished this, you have bought the book, you've done whatever, right? How different an experience would Amazon be if it told you, good job finding this book out of the search results, as opposed to saying, good job following the link from the Amazon Associates link on somebody else's blog. It's actually a very different experience that we don't necessarily tend to look at when we do our technology. So the path by which users come should be acknowledged, because it's them exploring the possibility space. The interesting key point for you guys as developers is that all of this can actually be quantified. You can actually measure how hard it was for people to come in versus via a particular path, what tools they chose to bring with them. You know, all of these elements, and actually, in game design, we actually have done this. You can actually arrive at a statistical measure of how hard it was to complete a given task. And then you can take the front page of Amazon and add up the values of every single button and every single link that are nested deep within that and arrive at a challenge rating for your entire interface and your entire experience. We do this in games where we graph this as you move through game levels, for example, where we statistically measure the first encounter, the next encounter, and so on, and track the difficulty rating as it goes to see how many people will actually make it all the way to the end. And then you can assess how hard your product is to use. One guess as to what the word that finishes this sentence is. You win. Which meant it was boring. An interesting thing about a lot of services is that they drive you towards succeeding at something, and then you succeed, and that's the end. Games have learned that that is not a good ending, that there should be more than one outcome, even to success. So when you buy something, it should tell you, it's really great that you bought that Cory Doctorow paperback, but you know what? You could buy the Cory Doctorow signed hardcover for only $50 more. Right? Greater challenge, you know, and there's secret ways to get a discount if you explore the site. Oh, all of a sudden people are really into it. Even better would be, oh, you know what? I bought that Cory Doctorow book. Congratulations, it's your 10,000th book purchase. We're going to send you the free, complete Charles Stross library. Games do this really, really, really well, and social media sites do it really, really, really badly. Okay? Variable feedback, really important. Either way, whenever this happens, everybody else who's around should know, hey, look, he just got the cool Cory Doctorow Charlie Stross payoff, right? Because it drives them towards increased participation as well. It's got to be visible to everyone. This is the key lesson behind feedback ratings, right? Have to be visible to everyone. Ironically, bottom feeding in games, this is where you go and kill the ants 10,000 times for 1 point of experience each time, and eventually you only needed 10,000 XP for level one, but you had a miserable experience. People will do this. Think link farming on Orkut. So low-risk activity for high reward is bad for fun, which is an interesting kind of point, because generally when we build services, we're trying to build things that are low-risk and high reward. But what you really want to do is have users riding right at the edge of what they can actually accomplish. That's where fun is. You want to be always giving them cooler challenges. Think Flickr photo challenges, something that they're not sure they can pull off. And, you know, buying the wrong shit on eBay has to make you go, oh, crap. It's really important to fun to realize that you did the wrong thing. Bottom line is that fun won't exist if there's no consequence. It's actually a really simple checklist. Absence of any of these features makes any form of interaction less fun. And if you want to know more about the fairly extensive science that runs behind this, and you know, it delves into cog sci, it delves into art theory, and a whole bunch of other stuff, you can check out the book. And if you're really geeky and really into games, you can check out the actual game grammar stuff, which is actually being worked on by a whole bunch of people at the link there. There you go.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a presentation from O'Reilly Media's Emerging Technology Conference.
This program is underwritten by the Kinetics Developers Conference, 2 days of learning cutting-edge tools for building client-side web applications and cross-platform browser extensions in Provo, Utah, on November 18th and 19th. The Kinetics banner is on the IT Conversations homepage. Our audio files are delivered by Limelight Networks, the high-performance content delivery network for digital media. The Conversations Network is a 501c3 nonprofit, and we need your help. For a tax-deductible donation of as little as $5 per month, you can support this channel and the rest of the Conversations Network. So please visit conversationsnetwork.org to become a member and help us continue to bring our programs to the world for free. The post-production audio engineer for this program was Mike Seifried. Our website editor was Peter Christensen. The series producer is Sathyesh Chakravarthy.
This is Phil Wendley. I hope you'll join me next time for another exciting presentation from eTech.